commencing in Chattanooga
on the Southern Railroad line.
On the Southern Railroad line.
Come on, Roy, grab on!
Where we going, Andy?
Who cares? Just don't fall off!
I got up in the morning when my sleep was done, and I felt that cheery Chattanooga sun. And I thank the Lord above that I was still alive as I waited for the 6:05.
Commencing in Chattanooga.
Chugga chugga in, and I said, there you are, as I scrambled in the old boxcar. Then I settled back, believing that the world was fine. I was traveling on the Southern line.
Commencing in Chattanooga. On the Southern Railroad line.
Hello and welcome to Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway for Sunday, May 22nd, 2011. My name is James Marino, and on the call this morning, we have Michael Portantier and Peter Felicia. Peter can be found three times a week at theatermania.com, also writes for Masterworks Broadway on Tuesdays, and also writes for the Newark Star-Ledger. Good morning, Peter.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good, thank you. Also with us is Michael Portantier. Michael is a writer and photographer. You can see his work at broadwaystars.com. Also, you can see his photography at followspotphoto.com. He also writes for npr.org. And good morning, Michael.
Good morning on this day after the world didn't end.
That's
you know,
right.
Michael, I was thinking about the world not ending, and knowing that the both of you were earlier this year on deadline for books, I wonder how those are coming. Did you count on the rapture?
For better or worse, mine is done, and supposedly will come out this fall. So I'm done. So if indeed the world had ended, at least I would have the satisfaction of knowing that I'd made my deadline.
They could have advertised it as the final book.
That's right. Yeah.
All righty. And Michael, how's that going for you?
Yeah, pretty much the same with me. I thought I just have to add a tiny bit more material, and then
you'll both let us know when it's ready, right?
Oh, sure.
It's a deal.
You guys spending the summer cutting down trees, pressing pulp, and making paper?
We'll leave that to the people who are far more butch than we are to do that. It doesn't sound like a job I'd be very good at.
All right. Well, you know, it's good to let the professionals take over. And I consider the both of you professionals in this discussion that we're going to have about the best original score, music and or lyrics written for the theater for the upcoming Tony Awards. The nominations are The Book of Mormon, The Scottsboro Boys, Sister Act, and Women on the Verge of a Nervous Breakdown. And today, this morning, I'd like to talk about each of the recordings that are out there and kind of get, you know, what I consider our professional opinions on what we think about this. So why don't we start with The Book of Mormon? Michael, why don't you tell me what you think about this score and, you know, give us your impressions of it.
Well, as I said in our podcast with John Kander, which I was really so happy that we got to speak with him, I do think it's interesting that one could argue that all of the nominated scores are pastiche scores. But I hasten to say that I don't use that word necessarily in a pejorative sense at all. I think that they are, you know, pastiche in the sense that they deliberately evoke specific types of songs and sometimes even specific songs, as in the case with the Book of Mormon. As many people have probably have read, even if they haven't seen the show, it pokes it like sort of very sentimental fun at various things that people have, you know, have already come to love in the musical theater, whether it be the I Have Confidence number from the film version of The Sound of Music, to the Small House of Uncle Thomas ballet from The King and I, which is sort of spoofed to hilarious effect in Act Two when the African villagers sort of give their interpretation of the whole Mormon Joseph Smith thing that they've been taught by the Mormon missionaries. But it's all done with such skill and such cleverness. And also, I do think that the actual melodies in Mormon are really quite delightful. The opening number is so fantastic. It's called Hello. And what a great opening number. I've suggested that they should that should be the number they do on the Tonys, and maybe even open the Tony Award ceremony with it, because it's so perfect. It's so introductory and it's so upbeat, and it's basically all the Mormons ringing the doorbells of various people to proselytize their faith. And the various kind of responses they give to the people they encounter and stuff like that. The score is by, I mean, the way it's credited is book, music, and lyrics by Trey Parker, Robert Lopez, and Matt Stone. So I'm not sure exactly what the division of labor is, but I think that probably that all three of them worked on all three aspects of the show. And Robert Lopez, as we know from Avenue Q, is really great at that kind of thing, like just spoofing something but having a sense of originality about it also, which is very important in this kind of thing, that you don't want to just slavishly imitate something. I mean, that doesn't take a whole lot of talent. But this is something much, much more talented and skillful than that. And then the two South Park guys, Trey Parker and Matt Stone, you know, they've many times stated their sort of love of musicals and have poked, you know, very had poked fun at them many times in the South Park series and the South Park movie, which is a really terrific animated musical. It's that thing where they sort of recognize the inherent ridiculousness in the form, if that's the right word, but also, you know, how transformative and how joyous it can be at the same time. So that's what the Book of Mormon is. And one final thing is that the score, you might not think that you would want to sit and listen to the CD over and over, because it is largely, much of the material is comic songs, and those don't tend to necessarily wear as well in repeated hearing as, more serious songs. But in this case, again, the melodies are so attractive and the lyrics are so clever that I do think that people will find themselves putting it on, whether through iTunes or an actual CD and listening to it a lot, to kind of, especially if they want to just kind of put on something that's going to put them in a really great mood.
All right, I was talking into a dead microphone, but thank you, Michael. Peter, what's your take on this?
Well, this reminds me very much of literally 10 years ago, in 2001, when there was a great deal of consternation about the producers and the Full Monty, that there was many arguments leading up to the Tony Awards about which would win the Tony, because after all, the producers was a pastiche score, and one written by a man who wasn't known for writing songs, that being Mel Brooks. Yes, he wrote Springtime for Hitler for the movie of the producers, and it's a wonderful song, but so much of that score was considered to be functional, and the Full Monty had a score that was really quite inventive. We had a new voice in the theater, David Yazbek, who we've heard from since, and whose name will come up today, of course. So I remember vividly being in the Tony press room the night of the producers' mammoth victory, and the thing was, when Best Score was announced, I heard a sound from the journalists in that room that I have never heard in the Tony room before or since. The sense of utter shock and surprise that it had really happened, that Mel Brooks' score had really beaten David Yazbek's score, that this would be the one bone that the Full Monty would be thrown. By the way, the Full Monty was a show that was greatly admired, but nevertheless, the producers was a juggernaut, so it was expected that the producers would win most everything. But to win this one, this was very surprising, because it really was a score that relied on jokes rather than melodies. And there was even doubt whether or not Brooks had written the melodies per se, did have help on it. All right, nobody had help this time beyond the three collaborators here. But we are talking once again about a jokey score, versus a score that aims higher, and that, of course, is the Scottsboro Boys, which we'll talk about. So it's not impossible at all that the Book of Mormon will take this prize just in the clean sweep attitude of the voters, because Book of Mormon is expected to win most everything. So it could very well happen. And if it happens, I personally will not be so devastated, even though I am rooting for Scottsboro Boys, because indeed this is a work of greater quality than The Producers is. I think the jokes are more pungent. They're not as obvious. For example, in I Want to Be a Producer, Matthew Broderick's song, you know, lunch at Sardi's every day. To me, that's real workaday lyric. Drink champagne until I puke. I don't think is artistry of the highest order. But the jokes here are much sharper, and I'm not going to give any away, because there are people, after all, who have not seen Book of Mormon who want to and are having trouble getting tickets, and there are people who are going to get this cast album in one way or another, and I want them to have that experience. Michael's right, of course, when he says that shows that rely on jokes in their lyrics tend to wear thin as you listen on and on. The saving grace here is definitely the fact that we do have genuine composers here at work. Robert Lopez really has a gift for melody, and again, we don't know the division of labor, but there are times when I was sitting in the O'Neill and thinking, ah, yes, yes, I have a feeling Robert Lopez did that wonderful musical phrase I just heard. So the melodies are very pleasing on their own level. So this is going to be an interesting race, more than many others this year, where things are foregone conclusions. But this is going to be as exciting a race as indeed The Producers and Full Monty was 10 years ago. We shall see, of course, how it plays out, but I can only say that while my sentiment is attached to the Scottsboro Boys, I won't feel that the Scottsboro Boys got, you should pardon the expression, screwed if the Book of Mormon does win Best Score. But, you know, all right, I'll go on. Fine, I'm done.
Okay. Well, I agree totally. And also, again, I was trying to make the distinction before. There are pastiche scores, you know, and then there are pastiche scores, and some are much more original than others. The Producers, first of all, a lot of the lyrics really are not very good at all. It worked because of the personalities involved on stage, and also just the whole general feeling of the score sort of worked. But yes, I mean, God, you know, you can do it, you won't rue it. I mean, How many times have we heard that before? Things like that. And also, I hate to say it, but there are some melodies in that score that are so close to the pre-existing songs that it's kind of, you know, probably almost actionable. There's one song called That Face.
Yeah.
Do you know that there is a previous
song called That Face, right?
And it's almost exactly the same.
It really is. It really is similar.
I mean, I'm surprised he got away with that. I really am. But that's and I really do not like it when one show just sweeps the awards as some kind of, you know, tsunami or juggernaut. You know, there was another award that was not, you know, everyone I know thinks that Kathleen Freeman deserved to win Best Supporting Actress for The Full Monty, just to cite one other example of shock. So I hope that doesn't happen. But I do think there's a good chance that Scottsboro will win Best Score, as it should. It should win it for the quality of the score, and it may win it for that reason, plus the sentimental factor of it being one of the last Cantor and Ebb scores we'll ever hear.
At the Tony Awards ball that year, by the way, Michael, in 2001, Kathleen Freeman came up to me and looked me right in the eye and said excitedly, "Is Nathan Lane here?" Yeah, you know, basically, but that meant so much to her, you know. So I was just so abused that this woman had a career long before Nathan Lane did, and it's hard to find a Jerry Lewis movie in which you don't find Kathleen Freeman. was so interested in meeting Nathan Lane, so I will never forget. She actually grabbed me by the lapels. She really wanted to know. So I'm glad at least she got a nomination, and we gave her a Theater World Award too, because she was quite lovely and really had the door sensibility that one needed for Jeanette's showbiz number, in which she talks about how things could be better with the guys. in the full Monty trying to get their act together. So, but anyway, back to this year's scores. I apologize for that digression.
No, absolutely. Her being excited about Nathan Lane there is probably a long line of people that were very excited at that point. And Sue, the line, of course, being led by Nathan himself. So, back to the Book of Mormon, I'm going to put both of you on the spot. For all four of these things, can you throw out your favorite track from that? Which one is your favorite from the Book of Mormon?
For me, it's the opening number, Hello. I think it's terrific.
Okay. Peter?
Well, the one I like best is Turn It Off, because I like that type of show song. Turn It Off is a song that deals with when you're faced with any type of temptation, just push it aside. Don't even think about it, which, needless to say, is easier said than done. So issues of whether or not one should fall to any type of temptation, and the authors do a good job of getting most of the big ones in there. It reminds me a little of musically of Put 'Em Back the Way They Was from Little Abner, and I think that's what they're homaging there musically. But nevertheless, that's the one that seems to really catch my fancy at this point.
I could easily have picked that one too. It's a terrific song, and the thing that's so great about it is that it's so up tempo and so peppy, and it's you know, but it's what it's saying is repress your emotions. You know? it's a fantastic piece. It really is.
So it was good to play against type on with lyrics against the tempos. All right. The next topic we're going to talk about, you guys branched into a little bit, is the Scottsboro Boys. And we were fortunate enough to talk with John Kander last week on the podcast. In case you missed it, go back and check it out. Peter, why don't you start us off there and tell us, you know, your general impressions of this recording? Oh, wait. Yeah. You know what? Let's back up for a second. Book of Mormon. Book of Mormon. Who released Book of Mormon? Is it which record label do we know? I'll dig up that information.
It's Ghostlight. Ghostlight did that one, and they did Sister Act, and they did Women on the Verge.
Okay, so we'll link to those things as well. So Scottsboro Boys, Peter. Back to that, Peter. Give us your impressions of that.
Well, when I was writing about Scottsboro Boys, one of the things I pointed out was that that in the second song called Commencing in Chattanooga, there was a B section that was so gloriously intoxicating musically that it really grabbed me. And Doug Abel, the artistic director of the Vineyard Theater, wrote me a note saying, you know, I swear to you, it was when I heard that B section that I said, I'm going to do this show. He said it had the exact same effect on me. So it's very nice that I'm not the only one who was really fascinated by that B section. What could one say about John Cannon that we didn't say last week and we won't say forever? He knows exactly what a song should sound like in the moment it's made for. This is a song called Alabama Ladies. Now, what happens in the Scottsboro Boys is nine boys are accused of raping two women, and we get the impression these are women who are no stranger to the sexual experience, that they are very loose ladies. But now, when they want to deflect attention that they've been plying their wares, they decide to come across as very high-toned women. So John Kander provides a very elegant type of melody for them when they're putting on the dog, saying that they're really women of fine character, and that the boys have been terrible with them. So that wonderful pseudo-elegant melody is terrific there. The song called Nothing, in which Hayward Patterson does a real mournful song about his fate, is exactly in keeping with the style of song that Burt Williams sang, Nobody, or a more serious version, shall we say, of Mr. Cellophane. Because while Amos in Chicago certainly doesn't have an easy life as a result of Roxy Hart, the fact is he's not in serious trouble the way that Haywood Patterson is, the accused man in one of the accused men in Scottsboro Boys. The Go Back Home song is so beautiful and haunting, one of Kander's best ballads ever. And what's so exciting, of course, is the fact that John Kander has had a career that has literally spanned 50 years as a composer, because his first composing effort was A Family Affair in 1961. Do the math. So as a result, it's so exciting to know that a man 50 years later has not run dry and can come up with as moving and serious a melody as he has in Go Back Home. Well, that's just the beginning of it, and I've got to leave something for Michael to say, so I'm not going to go through the entire score, but it's one that does hold up. I will say this, that the album does offer one song that was at the Vineyard that was dropped from the Broadway production, and it's when John Cullum is telling the boys that it takes time for these things to right themselves, and we know that it's not fair that it takes time. That's what we're left with while the song is playing, saying, "Yeah, I mean, but come on, these guys have done time." I mean, the legal process is so slow, and we feel bad for them. So if you get the album, you're going to get a song that the Broadway audiences didn't get, and it's a lovely song as well. So this is an album I've played more than I've played meaning of the three I have. I do not have the album for Women on the Verge of a Nervous Breakdown, but and of course I plan to get it, but of the other three nominees in this character, this is the one I come back to. This is also one that I plan to play many more times. It was great after we talked to John Cannon last week to put it on again. I thought, oh, let me hear it one more time. Well, it was more than one more time. So mm-hmm. Now it will be interesting, of course, to see if the voters get sentimental on this and say, well, this will probably be John Cander's last score. And yet, I imagine Curtin's got some votes because people were saying, well, this will probably be John Cander's last score. But even last week, he was talking about his new show with a new collaborator. So we're hoping, of course, this is hardly John Cander's last score. But I hate to see him lose the Tony because people say, ah, he'll write another one. He's still working, you know, so we don't have to be sentimental about this. Quality work, though, Book of Mormon is, this would get my vote.
Let me interject here for a second. I think that there are probably cast recording fans, especially the people on the cast recording mailing list that are streaming right now, that just to point out that this is the off-Broadway recording, and it's not the the Broadway cast recording that we're talking about.
Oh, indeed. Yes, there was an important cast replacement. Yes, that's a very good point. I'm glad you brought that up. We are listening to the cast because the gentleman who originated the main role took the role as Ray Charles in a musical that didn't happen. So good for you. Thank you.
We just have a minor change there, but it's an off-Broadway cast recording, and it doesn't totally reflect any reworking or a larger orchestration that they have done. And I guess that Fran and Barry Weisler did not do a new recording of it that I have heard of, and that Tony voters, I don't think got any different recordings to listen to.
I'm sure they didn't.
Other than this, Michael, what do you think about this Scottsboro Boys? Boys.
Yeah. by the way, I don't know for sure, but I expect the instrumentation is the same. So I expect the recording does reflect the Broadway show, except for the fact of, as Peter said, there's one song that was cut, and maybe some other minor changes in the score, and then the rather major change that we're hearing Brandon Victor Dixon, who did the role of Haywood off-Broadway rather than Joshua Henry, who did it on-Broadway and got a Tony nomination for his efforts.
I'm just saying that in the scope of things, the off-Broadway production probably did not have as large of a budget as a Broadway production would have had to do maybe an extra set of strings or add in something else that that you know in comparison.
Yeah, could
that's
be.
All. That's mm-hmm. what I'm really big.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
saying.
Could be. Mm-hmm.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And also, it's interesting because I'm sure that when this, by the way, this CD is from J Records, which is kind of interesting because they don't normally do.
Yeah, John Yap.
Yeah, and they don't normally do new shows so often, but yeah, and I imagine that when they did it, they kind of knew pretty much that the show would be coming to Broadway at some point. So I don't know how that was reflected in the you know the recording and whether they considered. Well, you know, this is one of those cases where. It's supposed to sound like a certain kind of music that you would hear in a minstrel show. So that's one more reason why they probably wouldn't have added to the orchestra in the way they used to when they would record something like Mame or Hello Dolly. But anyway, I don't want to, you know, bog us down on that. It sounds terrific. And I will say sort of, something similar to what Peter said. When I first saw and heard the show at the Vineyard, I sat there and I thought, I'm hearing a score that is the equivalent of Cabaret or Chicago. I couldn't believe how good it was, both the music and the lyrics. And it's so fantastic. I only, in a weird way, I'm sorry that they, in a way, I'm sorry that they went with the minstrel show concept because unfortunately, and wrongly, I think, that turned off so many people and scared so many people that they were not able to appreciate the score to the level that it should have been appreciated.
I once did an article on when I'd like to have been a fly on the wall of various sessions where people are working and creating shows. For example, when Michael Bennett pretended to fall when he was doing Chorus Line so that he could get the reactions that he would have to get on stage when Paul in Chorus Line fell. You may know that story, that he purposely pretended to be terribly injured. So I would have loved to have been a fly on the wall to see that. I would have loved to have been a fly on the wall when the creators, the people behind Porgy and Bess said to George Gershwin, George, you're going to have to cut a lot of music. Yeah, but I would have loved to have been a fly on the wall when these guys were debating, should we go with the minstrel show concept? Are we going to get in trouble for this? There's just such a knee-jerk reaction against minstrel shows. And, you know, we're also going to do blackface at the end. I would love to have heard the pros and cons at those meetings before they finally said, you know, we've got to do it. This is the way to do the show. It's the perfect framing device. It's going to make an ironic comment. And we're just going to have to trust that everybody's going to get that we're certainly not on the side of racism or anything like that. The rest of the show will make it clear that we are mourning for these black men and we have tremendous sympathy. And we want to tell their story and show how wrong they were. So, but I have a feeling when they listed all the assets and they listed all the liabilities of doing a minstrel show and doing blackface, that it was quite a long session before they finally said, we're just going to have to give it. We're going to have to do it. We just are. But I certainly imagine there were heated discussions and very, very long and concerted discussions about this.
Well, you know, what it comes down to is that the history of race relations in this country is, you know, so horrendous that we look back at things from, you know, early in the in the 20th century that were completely acceptable. And now we look at them and we absolutely cringe. And not just minstrel show. I mean, I was watching a clip of the 1936 film of Showboat. And, you know, she's singing, Helen Morgan is singing Can't Help Loving That Man of Mine, and it's lovely. And then Hattie McDaniel goes into these very kind of racist lyrics about how lazy and shiftless her husband is, you know. Sure. And then Irene Dunne starts to shuffle and sort of imitate a black person shuffling. Now, at that time, they were almost, I guess, thinking of it as celebrating that kind of music. And I suppose that was the idea with minstrel shows to a certain extent. And, you know, I mean, there are blackface numbers in Holiday Inn, and there are in The Jazz Singer, and there's a blackface number in that 36 version of Showboat. But I think it's essential that we not, you know, forget collectively in the collective consciousness that this stuff happened. And it's vital to see that that this used to be done and people used to accept it. So I really applaud, you know, the Scottsboro people and you know, these really short-sighted, foolish people who protested the show because they thought it was racist without even seeing it. They just, you know, they just really did a lot of damage, and they should be ashamed of themselves.
They did do a lot of damage. I'm not as quick to condemn them because I haven't walked in their shoes. So, but yes, I would have had more respect if they had seen the show. They may have come to a different conclusion. I have a feeling they wouldn't have. But nevertheless, yes, anybody who saw the Scottsboro Boys and was offended, again, I have not walked in their shoes, and as a result, I will not come down hard on that. But yeah, you got to see these things before you protest. And it was amazing to me how many people admitted they hadn't seen the show but were still offended.
You really do have to see it before you protest. And also,
yeah,
yes, Peter, I mean, I agree with you about not walking in their shoes, but I would kind of equate it to the way that some gay people get all flustered by the boys in the band, and we've had that discussion.
Yes,
when we had Mark Crowley on a few months ago. So I equate it to that. I just, well, anyway, it's yeah. historical perspective is what it comes down to, and not doing things like, well, you know, not. You know, we have revivals of shows from, you know, from years ago where they seem to. Because of colorblind casting, it indicates that there were black people who were fully integrated into society in all parts of the country, you know, 200 years ago. And it's just, you know, it's not true. So we need things like this to the Scottsboro Boys to show us and remind us that how far we've come and how far we still have to go.
Mm-hmm. Indeed.
All right. Peter, why don't you give me your favorite track from Scottsboro?
Oh, the Chattanooga song that I mentioned with that B section.
Okay.
And my favorite of many favorites would be Home, Go Back Home, excuse me, which is just a beautiful sort of nostalgic kind of very sad, beautiful lament kind of song that the boys sing, you know, when they're in the midst of their imprisonment. For the podcast that we did with John Kander, James played the bonus track of John Kander himself performing the song, and that is on a bonus track on the CD. But then the actual recording in the context of the show with the full cast of the all of the boys it's so beautiful. You've just got to listen to it.
All right, the next recording that we're going to talk about is also a recording from the London cast. It's not from the Broadway cast. It's of Sister Act. And if you guys want to weigh in on the recording and also what you remember from the performances that you attended, what do you think about this as insofar as being related to the best original score? Peter?
Well, yeah, I wouldn't count this out as a winner, ironically enough, and not necessarily because people will adore Sister Act on record or even in the theater, but I don't think it's impossible that Alan Menken will get a Tony as a type of lifetime achievement, that he has certainly suddenly been around for a long time. I mean, he had musicals produced in the 70s, and certainly he gave musical theater one of its classics. Is there a day in the year when Little Shop of Horrors is not being produced or at least in rehearsal. So I wouldn't be a bit surprised if he took it. He is the dark horse, no question about it. But still, dark horses have been known to win. So and while this is not, I think even he might admit, his best work, it's certainly good, solid work, and it's work that fits the show that they wanted to do. Again, as Michael pointed out, this is a pastiche score, and as a result, it's a little disconcerting after hearing the first two songs, Take Me to Heaven and Fabulous Baby, when you get used to a pastiche type of situation, to suddenly get the Mother Superior singing a very serious song that seems like it comes from a much more serious musical, Here Within These Walls. It's a lovely melody, by the way. I think Len Slater is a very good lyricist, and it's wonderful that for people who often say, oh, you never get breaks, and how can you get anywhere in this business? I mean, Glenn Slater has made it happen. I mean, not only has he worked with Alan Menken, but he's worked with Andrew Lloyd Webber. And I'm sure there was a time that not even in his wildest dreams he smelled that coming. So good for him. And though I will admit that I believe that if this award goes to Sister Act, it will be because of Alan Menken and his career rather than Glenn Slater's particular achievements in Sister Act.
All right, Michael, what do you think?
Yeah, I don't have a lot to say about this because honestly, I have the CD. I haven't listened to it too much. I do agree about Glenn Slater. I've been saying that since he collaborated with Menken on the new songs for The Little Mermaid, which although that was a really very badly directed and produced show, I actually thought that the additions to the score were wonderful. And that's a hard thing to do, I think, to take a pre-existing score and add to it, especially if it's one of the people adding to it was not the original person. The lyrics for the film version of The Little Mermaid, of course, were written by Howard Ashman. But Glenn Slater came in and they wrote, I don't know, like six or maybe more new songs for The Little Mermaid, all of them terrific. And Sister Act, I do think it's a very professional, very catchy pastiche score. I'm looking now. I'm sorry, I should have prepared a little more. I don't think the London album has this song in the Broadway show that I really objected to, where the three henchmen of the head bad guy basically sing about how they're going to go to the convent and kind of have sex with the nuns, basically what they're saying. I mean, that's what they want to do anyway. So that's something I don't miss if that's not in fact here, which I don't think it is. Patina Miller is a terrific presence with a terrific voice, and she's very enjoyable on the album. Unfortunate not to have Victoria Clark's performance recorded for posterity. But who knows, maybe they'll do a video someday. You know, people, they're starting to do that kind of thing now.
Good.
You know. Good. And I do, just in closing, I agree with what Peter said. It's not the most stylistically cohesive score in terms of tone, because a lot of it is very jokey, and then the transition into the more serious songs really does not seem very seamless, to say the least.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
All right. So, Michael, if you had to pick a song out of it, what would you pick?
I like Take Me to Heaven. I really do.
Okay. Peter?
Well, as somebody who's seen all three versions of Sister Act going back to Pasadena way back when, I can't say that any song has really tickled my fancy to the point of which I could say I really have a favorite. I can't do that. Yeah, I just don't have one that really reaches out to me and makes me hum it again whistle while walking down the street, which I'm notorious for doing. So let's say I like them all the same.
Excellent. Everybody gets a trophy.
Right.
All right. Next on the list Distract is a London recording, but it is released here in the States by Ghostlike Records, and we'll have links on the show page for all these recordings if you want to go and check them out yourself. Like the Ghostlike website and the J website have clips you can listen to as well if you want to take a listen to that. And also, NPR did this really interesting thing back on Book of Mormon. NPR previewed the entire album
of
Book of Mormon, and you could listen to the entire album off of the NPR website. I don't know if that thing is still live. We linked to it on BroadwayStars.com, but I don't know if they were going to only do it for a few days or if it's still up and available. I'll check that out and put that in the show notes as well.
By the way, before I forget, I just yesterday was watching TV. I forget what show it was, and there were multiple commercials for Broadway shows. I saw two separate, slightly different ads for the Book of Mormon. And in one of them, they refer to the cast album as a soundtrack.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And so I guess we just have to give up, don't we? I mean, but I'm not giving up yet. I mean, I guess apparently because chains like Tower Records used to, I believe it was Tower, I don't want to misspeak here. And chains like that, they would put anything that was a musical under the label soundtrack. But as anyone knows who cares to think about what the word means, a soundtrack refers to the literal track that goes along the side of a piece of film on which the sound is recorded. Now, it's not even done that way anymore so much because in the digital era, but that is what it refers to. So that's why when you say a soundtrack for a Broadway show, it has no meaning whatsoever, and you should not use that term. You should call it a cast recording or a cast album.
You know, it's funny. I don't know why there's such consternation on this in the sense of people don't understand it. I remember being 16 years old in Farrington's record store in Arlington, Massachusetts, and I had two albums of The King and I in my hand. And one said original cast album and one said original soundtrack. And I'm looking at both, and I'm looking at one with Yul Brynner and Gertrude Lawrence on the floor, each trying to put his her head lower than the other. And the other one, I'm looking at Deborah Carr elegantly in her dress there, and there's The King. And I'm looking back and forth, and I'm seeing original soundtrack and original cast, and finally it dawned on me, oh, yes, of course, a movie has a track of sound. I get it. This is the movie. This is the stage show. I was sweet 16 years old. I mean, I don't understand why this is so hard for so many people to realize.
Well, because I guess they didn't grow up on it. And like I said, those record stores would lump them all together stupidly. And now we, you know, and that resulted in this. And I guess, I don't know, when people use soundtrack to mean cast album, I guess they're thinking of the tracks on a CD. Maybe that's
where that's fair. That's fair. Yes. You know, that's very interesting because in the old days, we never used to call them tracks. We called them cuts.
Right.
But they are referred to as tracks on CDs. That's, oh boy, good for you, Michael.
Well, I'm just speculating.
I'm playing devil's advocate. That lets them a little off the hook with me, I have to admit. You know, I can understand why the mistake would be made, but it is surprising to me how many old timers make that mistake. It really does amaze me. On a side note, I was pointing out in my Masterworks column last week that in All I Need is the Girl in Gypsy, Tulsa sings a stare bit, meaning Fred Astaire bit. I'm being like Fred Astaire. And I said, it's amazing to me how many people think that he's saying a stare bit, that he's climbing upstairs the way dancers used to do. And so many of my readers, who are people who have been following musical theater from now and forever, said to me, I always thought he meant he was going up the stairs. But anyway, the script of the show does prove he is saying a stair as in Fred Astaire. So, you know, it's amazing how many misconceptions, God knows how many I have, and God knows how many both of you have, you know. So as William Goldman said in The Season, it's hard to be smart. It just is. It just is.
It's almost like Gilbert and Sullivan shows all need super titles.
Yeah,
we make sure.
Yeah.
Pirate, pilot, things
sure,
like that.
Sure.
All right. So the next topic we're going to talk about is women on a verge of a nervous breakdown. Peter, you said that you haven't listened to this album yet, so why don't we start with Michael?
Oh, sure. It's a terrific album from Ghostlight, as I predicted, and then I won't keep repeating it. And I'm certainly not the only one who said it.
You certainly aren't.
And I'm not the first Western person who said it either. The show comes across, the score comes across 8 million times better on the CD than it did in the show, because for some reason, it's really amazing. After a series of an unbroken string of successes as a director, including The Light in the Piazza and South Pacific and that wonderful production of help me out, Peter. I'm just at the Belasco, the play about the Awake and Sing. Is that right?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Bart Scher.
Yeah. Bartlett Scher just totally seemed to lose it with Women on the Verge, and aided and abetted by his designers, who just created this chaos of projections and scenery moving on and off constantly, scenes that lasted literally 30 seconds on stage before a new set came in and a new projection was there to distract you from everything else that was happening. It was just horrendous. But the score itself is quite wonderful by the aforementioned David Yazbek, who I think is, you know, really, unfortunately, still one of our most underrated talents. Because for whatever reason, I mean, in any other year, the Full Monty would have been a much bigger hit and would have gotten much more attention if it hadn't been the year of the producers. And now here again, he was sabotaged by the production and the direction of the show. But I'm glad we have this. It would be interesting to see if I suspect that subsequent productions of Women on the Verge, and I hope there are some, will be far better than what we saw on Broadway. I mean, there are some inherent problems in the writing itself, because the book writer, and I suppose Yazbek has some responsibility too, they made mistakes like keeping too many minor characters and trying to give them all something to do. But that said, you know, I think that other productions that are far more simple in terms of sets and projections, things like that, are going to be much better received than the Broadway one was. And I hope, and I'm glad that the album exists, because as we all know, an existing Broadway cast album is pretty much essential to ensuring subsequent productions of a show, because people hear it and they say, oh, you know, we really want to try to do that. Whereas if they can't hear it, then it's just not in the consciousness and they're not going to do it. So bravo, you know, to Ghostlight for doing it. And my favorite song, I think, well, one of my favorites before you ask me is the opening, Madrid Is My Mama, which is done by Danny Burstein and the Company. And that song, there's a perfect example. Its position was switched in the show, I believe, during previews. So at least they were trying to get it right. And you know, but here it's included right at the beginning where it should be.
All right, Peter. I know that you haven't listened to the recording, but you did see the show. So right. tell us what your thoughts are.
Well, first off, I think that David Yazbek is becoming the Martin McDonagh of the musical theater. Martin McDonagh is a playwright who I think is tremendous. He's the one person whose plays I actually count the minutes until seeing. And I mean that. I mean that the day I'm seeing a Martin McDonagh play, I'm saying, ah, only 4 more hours, only 3 more hours. He's never won a Tony Award. No matter how many wonderful shows he's done, it just hasn't happened. And now David Yazbek is going to go down to his third defeat, I'm sorry to say. And because I also thought Dirty Rotten Scoundrels was a wonderful score. Now, that year he was up against Light in the Piazza, so I'm not surprised that happened. But again, bad timing. that if it had been another season, David Yazbek would have won the prize for Dirty Rotten Scoundrels, which includes a song that in happier musical times would have been a standard that every American would have known, Nothing Is Too Wonderful to Be True. A beautiful song, would have become a cabaret standard, et cetera, et cetera.
And so, that incredible opening number for Sherry Renee Scott, Here I Am, is that the title?
You bet. Sure,
oh,
sure.
Just great.
Yeah, it's a wonderful score, and the 11 o'clock number, which is, I think, believe is called "Dirty Rotten Number," is terrific too. and he gets the jokes in the right place. He knows how to joke. I mean, he's a funny man, and it's delightful to hear songs with jokes. And so I was a big fan of Dirty Rotten Scoundrels as much as Full Monty. And in fact, that year I even thought Dirty Rotten Scoundrels had a very good chance of winning the award as Best Musical, because it was up against Spamalot and Light in the Piazza. And I thought it might the votes would be split so much between those two that Dirty Rotten Scoundrels could succeed. So I was counting the minutes, really, when I went to the Belasco Theater to see Women on the Verge of a Nervous Breakdown. And I have to say, I was tremendously disappointed, not only by the show, but I must admit by the score, too. However, as I said before in this podcast, I don't know anybody who has this album who isn't thrilled beyond belief and is saying, I'm listening to it over and over and over and over and over again. And it is just wonderful. And
Peter,
so, yes.
you are going to be amazed, even though I know you already recognize this phenomenon.
Yeah. I mean, so it's just I haven't got around to getting this album. It's been a busy time for me. But nevertheless, the fact remains that what 150 people who have talked to me about this cannot be wrong. You know, it just has to be. So it's funny. Michael mentioned the Madrid song, and perhaps it is wonderful. But I will say that it did look to me like this song was switched in the show because they wanted to have a rousing opening number that would be fun and exciting. But the problem was that this song came after what happens in the movie as well, that there is a phone call that comes in that the Sherry Renee Scott here is sleeping, hears, and it puts her on, she has to get up and she has to get out of that apartment fast to make right of something that has happened, or you know, whether or not she can is another issue. So we're emotionally involved with her plight, and then we get this happy-go-lucky song about Madrid. It was not the right decision to make that the opening number. But, you know, that won't be an issue unless, of course, Michael, you tell me, does the CD open with that phone call? Or does it just
I don't think it's on there. Good, but I was going to say,
that's all for the best. Go ahead.
Yeah, no, I mean, I absolutely agree with you, Peter, but I would say that the problem was that the phone call should have come after the opening.
You bet. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah, that would have solved it for me entirely. You know, I mean, frankly, I'm not too thrilled with the idea of what Lehman Engel used to call a Merry Villagers number, you know, where everybody is essentially in an operetta saying, isn't life beautiful in fill in the blank location, you know, I don't think that that's really a good idea to start a show with anymore. I think we need something a little more subtle in an opening number, but nevertheless, if you're going to do that type of opening number, yeah, please put the phone call after the happy-go-lucky song, because aren't we supposed to care about this lady, and now suddenly we're supposed to be more interested in work a day every day isn't every day is a holiday in Madrid, or whatever the feeling was of the song, and you know, come and land of love and laughter, or whatever. I'm being unfair to it because I don't know what it actually right. The lyrics are, but traditionally any song that deals with a location is intent on telling you how wonderful the location is, and I imagine this song does too. But anyway, yep, apparently I have a treat ahead of me. And it's funny because just last night, while driving down to Red Bank to see Jacques Brel, with, by the way, Tony nominee from Scottsboro Boy, Forrest McClendon, in it, I was listening to the demo of the Full Monty, and it reminded me once again how terrific it was, and even some of the drop songs were really quite nice too to hear. There's a song that was dropped in which I guess it's Jerry in the Full Monty is trying to convince people to grab opportunity by the balls. And there's a lyric that the next lyric is, let go of my balls, says opportunity. You know, I mean, so that's kind of funny. You know, I mean, yeah. And that song was dropped. But I mean, again, this guy's got a wonderful sense of humor, and I wish him well. And so I hope the fourth time is the charm. And I hope he doesn't get discouraged from writing musicals. And I guess we have Adam Gettle to thank for him. That's the irony. I believe that's true, that when they were looking for someone to do Full Monty, Adam Gettle, I believe, recommended David Yazbek for the project. So thank you, Adam.
Yeah, definitely.
If it's you.
So Women on the Verge is produced and released by Shikaboom Ghostlight Records. On the Shikaboom website, it has listed that it has a bonus track in it of My Crazy Heart, which was parentheses the original show opening. Now they have My Crazy Heart as track number 6, so maybe there was a rearrangement of it at the time.
No, well, it's
go ahead.
Michael. I'm sorry. Go ahead, explain it, Peter.
Sure, well, it's interesting looking at the IBDB website. They still have the song listing apparently before opening, because My Crazy Heart is the opening song here and Madrid is the opening song of Act 2. So I have a feeling that My Crazy Heart refers to that.
It's just to clarify, I guess this is what you said. It's on the album as track number 6 as My yes. Crazy Heart. And then additionally, there's a bonus version that says original show opening.
Yes.
Yeah, according to IBDB, My Crazy Heart opens the show, and My Crazy Heart reprise comes later. So what was once the reprise of My Crazy Heart is now My Crazy Heart. As is. So that explains that.
All right. So, Michael, what's your favorite? Oh, you told Madrid Is My Mom is your favorite, Pete?
Yeah, I really do like it. And, you know, it's funny what Peter said. Sondheim refers to them as the villagers on the green number. Where everyone is kind of singing the same thought at the same time, you know, and, you know, here we are and here we live and this is our life. But in this case, I do think, I mean, I have sometimes problems with those kind of songs too. But in this case, since the show is about so many people, so many characters, I thought that it did fit in well at the beginning, and that they just this whole structure of it was wrong. They should have done that and then got into the situation with Sherry Renee Scott's character and her man walking out on her and the bed burning and all of that stuff.
Peter,
well, one thing that has to be said here is the fact that I'm starting to wonder if indeed the Tony nominators were able to get recordings of this beforehand, and if that changed their mind, because after all, the notable omission here is Catch Me If You Can. Catch Me If You Can was nominated as Best Musical and yet didn't show up here as Best Score. And certainly Mark Shaiman and Scott Whitman, even though they only have really to speak of one real Broadway musical to their credit. Yeah, they worked on The Martin Short Show. But in terms of, and I put quotation marks around this term, real musicals, you know, Hairspray was certainly beloved by one and all, damn close to that. That's not that much of a hyperbole to say by one and all. So a lot of people thought that the nomination would go to Catch Me If You Can. In fact, people I was talking to expected that Catch Me If You Can would be nominated for Best Score and not for Best Musical. It turned out to be just the opposite. But so the fact that David Yazbek, with a closed show, got in while Mark Shaiman and Scott Whitman with a currently running show is a testament to the fact that there were people who believed very strongly in Women on the Verge of a Nervous Breakdown. Michael's 100% correct. There is nothing more valuable than a cast album to spur future productions. And as a result, there are going to be many directors who are going to say, I can fix Verge on the Nervous Breakdown. Just as Merrily We Roll Along has never died because everybody believes he can fix it.
And the Baker's Wife.
Yep. Neither of those two shows would be produced with the regularity that they are produced had those cast albums not been in existence. And I believe that's also true, even though this show cannot compare in terms of productions with those two. The Grass Harp. The Grass Harp certainly has received many productions, I mean, I'm sure, because people heard that cast album and said it's glorious and we got to do it.
So, Peter, which track do you think from Women on the Verge it would be?
I have to pass again because... Okay. In fact, even when Laura Benanti did her song, the tour down the house, the night I was there at the Belasco, I said, this is a triumph of performance over material. And also when Patti LuPone did her big 11 o'clock number, I also thought, she is working so hard to make the song sound better than it is. So I didn't like the score at all, and I am so looking forward to saying, ah, I was wrong. Ah, it's wonderful. I look forward to that.
I will be really interested to hear, and I'm sure you'll be honest if you have that reaction.
I'm being honest here, saying I love to be proved wrong when it turns out I get something that pleases me. It's worth it for me to be wrong, so to speak, if I get a new piece of art that enhances my life.
Great. All right. So let's wrap that section up. We wanted to talk briefly about Sony Masterworks Broadway, the Masterworks Broadway series. As Peter mentioned earlier in the podcast, he does write for them on Tuesdays, but Michael actually brought this up and wanted to talk about Sony Masterworks. So, Michael, why don't you tell us what's on your mind?
Oh, yeah, I know we want to wrap up, but I did just want to acknowledge this series because it's so valuable. They are releasing as physical CDs with actual, booklets with them. Imagine that. Fabulous old recordings, such as I just got the studio recording of On Your Toes. A lot of this whole series that was conducted by Lemon Engel, the dean of Broadway musicals. And this recording has Jack Cassidy and Portia Nelson in the leads. But they're also, they've put out a lot, and they continue to come out. One thing that's coming up is, the 1964, the Music Theater of Lincoln Center recorded several of the shows that they did. We all know the famous Annie Get Your Gun re-recording with Merman and Bruce Yarnell. But they're coming out with The Merry Widow with Patrice Munsell. That was a recording that was made, but I think that's been out of print for years. So that'll be
And I don't believe it was ever on CD before.
No.
I could be wrong about that, but I don't recall ever seeing that on CDs. So it is nice that that's going to be available. I've heard it already, and what's so wonderful is hearing so many musicians in the pit. It's just so lush. And I dare say, even people who don't think they like operetta, I'm not crazy about operetta, or at least I didn't think I was, but this one really sounds like a Broadway show. So as a result, I think there may be some very pleasant surprises for people who are operetta phobic, that it plays better than you might think. All right, it is true that it ends with two people singing I love you so. Yes, it does. But nevertheless, it's a hell of a recording, and I recommend it highly. So I'll tell you right now. Yes, I bought the long playing record way back when, but out of a duty of completeness rather than anything else, I never ever played it once because I thought it would be much interest to me. And that's why when young people say to me, I'm not going to listen to Bye Bye Birdie, that's 1960, that's 50 years ago, I'm not critical, because in the 60s it was very hard for me to listen to operetta from way back when. Yes, ideally we should all listen to things from way back when to learn the history of it, and we can really fit in the pieces of why certain things fit in. But I understand why young people are reluctant to do that they're interested in the here and now. But this Merry Widow was a very pleasant surprise to me.
And, again, we have to go. I know I have to go. But one thing I'm really looking forward to is something I have never heard before. And even if it's not any good, I don't know. Peter, you can tell me. This sounds so fascinating. A 1955 recording of Carousel with, again, Patrice Munsell as Julie, Robert Merrill as Billy, Florence Henderson, presumably as Carrie, and it says George S. Irving, who I guess must be Mr. Snow, but that's interesting because he's really, I don't usually think of him as a high tenor.
He played Jigger, maybe?
I don't think so.
Hold on for one second.
Oh, he's got it.
I will tell you because I have the information here.
Okay,
exactly.
Great.
And it's organized by opening night date.
George Irving, by the way, as opposed to George S., as he's spilled here, indeed played Jigger.
Oh, really?
Yeah. A gentleman named Herbert Bank was Enoch Snow. He doesn't mean, I don't know who he is. And a Gloria Lane was Nettie. But indeed, Florence Henderson is Carrie. And I listened to it yesterday. It's a lovely recording. What's also very nice about it is the two songs that don't show up in Carousel very much are in it. Geraniums in the Winter,
right.
Is in it. And The Highest Judge of All.
Yeah.
Billy's song when he demands to essentially see the Supreme Court in heaven.
Change music, wasn't it?
It was. I remember very vividly seeing that Lincoln Center revival, and it was definitely an in one. But what's significant about this recording is that when it came out, it was a more complete Carousel recording. At that point, all we had was the original Decca recording, and God loved the Decca people for doing a good job with getting as much down as they did. But more came out. Don't forget, when Decca made the recording, they were still doing 78s. In fact, the soliloquy was split, and you know that's a shame when you have to have that wonderful piece, which to me, by the way, is the supreme achievement of Broadway musicals. If I have to ask, what is the one singular achievement, the one song, and just call it a song is really even doing an injustice, but I think the soliloquy is the greatest thing that's ever been created for musical theater. So to have it interrupted because it was on 78, so this was a significant album of its time, so it's nice to have it back.
Well, I just purchased it.
Oh, good.
Because I've mentioned before, the Carousel is possibly the penultimate show for me.
I understand.
I love.
Understand.
I can't get enough of Carousel.
I understand.
All righty. So that's great. Masterworks Broadway. I'm going to link to it on the show page for everybody to go visit it and check it out. It would be great to support them as they support the theater community. So, Peter, in between all your free time, you also run a small little organization called the Theater World Awards. And tell us about what's coming up for the Theater World Awards.
June 7th, 2 o'clock, August Wilson Theater. We're looking forward to giving out a total of 14 awards. Traditionally, the Theatre World Awards have given out 6 awards to men and 6 awards to women making either their Broadway or their off-Broadway debuts. So if you made your off-Broadway debut and then make your Broadway debut, you're still eligible. And these are awards that have been going on since 1945. And this is the 67th. It is, unfortunately, the first year we'll be doing it without John Willis. John Willis was there from the very beginning, and he died very shortly after last year's ceremony, and we'd like to think that we kept him alive long enough for him to at least attend last year, because he had been ill for a long, long time, but he made it to the ceremony, and really, within a matter of days, had died. So, so of course, we're dedicating this year's ceremony to him, but we are also giving out 2 other awards. We're giving out an award to, which is called the Dorothy Loudon Award. Dorothy Loudon wanted an award given out in her name to somebody who we had missed for one reason or another. Sometimes we don't get to see people when they replace in a Broadway show, and then that's their Broadway debut after all, so they're not eligible, but we miss them, so this is our chance to get an award to somebody who really deserves one. And then we're also doing a Lunt Fontanne Award that Aaron Frankel has instituted for the best ensemble, so we're giving that out too. June 2nd, June 7th.
Yeah.
Right, 7. Lucky 7. 2 p.m., that's where the 2 came from. And August Wilson Theater. Anybody who's interested in attending, please email me privately. There's a link to me both on Masterworks Broadway and on my Theater Mania column. So if you'd like to attend, let me know. And we'll see if we can get you in.
Excellent. Great. So let's wrap up here. I want to thank you guys and remind everybody that you can subscribe to these podcasts by going to the front page of BroadwayStars.com. And on the right-hand side, there is a Broadway Radio section. Underneath that, there is a subscribe button. That way, each and every time we have a new episode of Broadway Radios This Week on Broadway, it'll be automatically downloaded to iTunes for you. If, in fact, you'd like to listen to us in some other way, you can listen to us through the Zune Marketplace.
You can find us there. You can also listen to us on your Android device by going to Google's Listen, or on your BlackBerry through Stitcher Radio. Stitcher is an app that you could download for your BlackBerry, Android, or iPhone, iPod Touch, and listen to us there. If, in fact, you are in front of our computer, you can listen to us at Broadway World Radio, Wednesdays at noon, Thursdays at 7 p.m., and Saturdays at 2 p.m. You can contact us by going to BroadwayStars.com/radio, and all of our contact information for Peter, Michael, myself, and various other things is there, so you can call us or email us or do whatever you'd like to do. So, Michael, we could find you at BroadwayStars.com and at Follow Spot Photo. Anything else going on?
Well, just finishing up that Sweeney Todd book, and I just directed a show off Broadway, so that's over now, so I'm looking forward to a little bit of a break.
Excellent. Time spent out on the beach this summer, right?
A little bit, yeah, hopefully.
Excellent. Peter, you have the impending PeterFelicia.com website going to be launched sometime in the future, right?
Yes, and I assure you, you will not find this body on the beach.
I'm sure you will be...
I haven't been in a bathing suit since 1971.
10th Row Center, that's your beach.
Right.
That's your beach. All righty.
Alice Theater.
Great. So on behalf of Peter and Michael, this is James Marino saying thanks so much for listening to Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway. Bye-bye.
Thanks. Bye.
Bye.
Changing cast of thousands in the back. The flag goes down, a brand new scene, and then the flag goes up, the scene is over, they get out, it all begins again. Madrid, my mama, my creator, she might make me crazy, but I'm not gonna fight her. I'll just crawl back up inside her. So if you wanna go ahead and die, amen. In another 10 minutes you'll be born again. And it'll all be here and it'll all be new. And what you wanna do with it is up to you. Cause maybe life is hard and maybe love is fickle. It's all a steady trickle from an umbilical. Every bump of the road, every stop, every start, you can